happy to be here, and I also want to say, Deborah, thank you so much for bringing this panel together. I think it's going to be having to be an annual panel,
because
things are so up in the sky in terms of the fact that it's really recent. And so I'm going to be speaking about adolescence, and I this is a picture of myself as an adolescent at my sweet 16. And you have to say, oh, you haven't changed at all. This is my little brother, George, and he's now about, you know, way higher. But this slide just basically indicates that I don't have any conflict of interest in terms of... And I do want to acknowledge my collaborators at UC San Francisco, Charlie Irwin, Jane Park, Kathleen Tebb, and Josephine Lau, as well as our funder at the Bureau of Maternal and Child Health. So I'm going to try to cover the topic of adolescence and identify opportunities within the ACA. And you just heard a wonderful presentation, so I'm going to skip fairly quickly over some of those slides, but I do want to indicate how these benefits really impact a population that's very much in need of preventive health services. All of us recognize that this is a very important age population. I think it's important for you to know that there are 42 million adolescents ages 10 to 24 living in our country. It's becoming an increasingly diverse population. If you think about your own state, in California, for example, we have done analysis that show that 1 out of 8 adolescents living in the country lives in our state. So when things happen in California, they impact the rest of the country. And I think it's powerful data for you to know how many young people live in your state. And in fact, I've done studies that show the trends over time. And over a 10-year period, we increased the number of young people living in California by 34%, when the rest of the country was about 13%. And when I travel a lot around the country and sometimes get into conversations with my airplane mate and share that, I say, you know, in California, we've often called this a youth quake, when actually, you know, it's pretty revolutionary, a youth quake because, for example, the Department of Transportation is concerned about having more young drivers. One time, a gentleman turned to me and said, well, that means I must build more, we must be building more prisons because of all these young people. So I want to say that as a champion for young people, it's very sobering when I hear this, and I say, in fact, we should be investing in schools and jobs and housing for these young people because it's cheaper than leaving people in prison. I want to make the point about how ethnically diverse, so when we talk about low-income populations and eligible populations, we need to recognize that the ACA is extremely important, both in terms of Medicaid as well as Medicaid expansion, as well as SCHIP. And that 1 in 10 were immigrants or foreign-born. So we also have to recognize that there's still many people that are being left out and being marginalized. And if you go to the healthpolicy.ucsf.edu, we've done research on the health needs of the DREAMers. Those are the delayed action for childhood arrivals that might be of interest to you. I want to underline that the three-fourths of lifetime diagnosable problems occur by the age 24. So as MCH individuals here, we know the life course, and it's a very important period for intervening. Many of these young people have a special health care need. 5% of them have a disabling chronic condition, and you'll be hearing about children with special needs in a little while. They have very high rates of emergency department use. Under the age of 4 or after the age, of 75, they're the population that uses ED. But as researchers and practitioners in the field, you need to understand all the reasons why the ED visit might be happening. And part of it is the morbidity and mortality having to do with car crashes. Childbirth is a very leading cause of hospitalizations, but mental health issues come very soon after. Traditionally, this is a population that has had very low rates of coverage. So before the ACA, about 10% of young people were not covered. But 33% of young adults ages 18 to 25. So while I'm here to speak about adolescence, I also stretch that period into the transition into young adulthood. And in fact, I would say that part of the reason why the Obamacare was very important about expanding up to age 26 was reaching a population that would have been already covered under their parents, but stretching it increased over 3 million individuals getting into health care coverage. It was very important from a strategic perspective. But some work that's been done around looking at billing data for some of these young people shows that in the first few months of this expansion, 42% of the billing for this population, so this is not the lowest income, these are families that have health insurance coverage, and stretching it from age 22 to 26, 42% had to do with mental health services. So that is a tremendous unmet need for this population. So clearly, this is a very critical time for promoting positive development, the life course perspective, fostering healthy choices, life skills, and we really need to continuously think about social determinants and the role of disparities as it impacts the health and well-being of this very important population. We've been very fortunate that we have guidelines, both the HEDIS guidelines, Bright Future guidelines, that really do emphasize prevention, and that is, to me, the diamond in the crown of Obamacare. We need to recognize that up to now, we've done a very poor job of covering prevention for this population and for many populations. My spotlight is on this group right now. And we know that relatively small proportions receive preventive services. And in fact, here again are the disparities. So that if you're uninsured, if you're low income, if you're Latina or Black, you're much less likely to have that kind of coverage, and there's tremendous geographic and regional disparities. When we think about the medical home, which is part of what we're striving to do for families, only about half of adolescents, their parents report that their child has a medical home, and that it's lower for some conditions. For example, those adolescents who've been diagnosed with some kind of mental health condition have less likelihood of having a medical home, and those with both physical and mental had even less. So there's a lot of room for expansion of prevention into this age group. We also have data that shows that very few adolescents have received the type of anticipatory guidance and screening that's so crucial. Only about a third received even basic information about seatbelt use, helmet use, even secondhand smoke. Less than half around healthy eating, and only 10% received all six prevention areas that have been prioritized and addressed. Another indicator to me, I think, is very important for you to think about sort of the smoke detector in the room. A smoke detector in the field of adolescents and young adults is time alone. Time alone with a provider gives a young person an opportunity to disclose more sensitive information. When a provider actually underlines that the visit is confidential, not only is a young person more likely to disclose private information, but they're much more likely to come back for a second appointment. So if we're thinking about continuity, that is very important. And here, again, a slight change, a difference between males and females, not surprising because oftentimes moms will allow their sons to have a private conversation with their doctor. But again, in terms of social disparities, Latinas and Latinos, younger females, and lowest incomes are less likely to have that valuable time alone. And by the way, as a parent, we know that time alone isn't just important around disclosing information, but a major accomplishment of this time period is to really start inculcating in young people the skill sets that they need to be able to navigate this very complex healthcare system. And so they need to be able to understand, how do I communicate with the provider around the issues that I'm concerned about? This is a little political cartoon, one of my favorites. The physicists are working together, and then it says, and then a miracle occurs in between some of this formula, and I think you should be more explicit here about step two. So I think we all recognize the complexity of introducing Obamacare. I was very happy when you talked about the introduction of Medicaid and how long it took. I happen to have the honor of being the director of the Philip R. Lee Institute for Health Policy Studies. And Phil Lee worked with President Johnson when they implemented Medicaid and Medicare. And Phil was responsible for desegregating over 1,000 hospitals in the South because he said to them, if you don't desegregate your hospital, I will not give you any Medicare dollars. And I had the pleasure of working at Grady Memorial Hospital, which was built before 1965 when civil rights laws were passed. And Grady Memorial Hospital in Atlanta is built like the letter H, half for whites and half for blacks. So he was instrumental in being sure that that hospital and many others were desegregated. We know that enrollment has been a very important issue for this young people, and in fact, moms have been very influential in getting their young people to be enrolled. So this is a great slide that I've taken from Young Invincibles. Mom would be happier if you got health insurance. And I want to say that a year ago when the major campaigns were happening, and now they're happening as well in terms of enrolling young people, one of the things that they did the day after Valentine's Day was called the campaign Friends with Benefits as an opportunity to get people more enrolled in health insurance. I'll go very quickly on the fact that many of the key elements that have been mentioned are very important for young people, particularly around continuity of coverage for young people in foster care, so that as they age out of foster care, they will be covered under the ACA up to age 25. That's a very important element given the high risks and mental health needs of this population. A second area really has to do with equity between mental health and physical health. So I don't want to underline or repeat things that you've already been hearing, but I just want to say that those things are important for the population that I'm covering. And again, the screening services are very important for this population. And I had probably one of my career highlights was serving on this committee that made the recommendations around no copay for preventive services. So what is the progress thus far? We know that there's over 4 million uninsured adolescents in this age group of 10 to 19. Many of them are Latino and African American. We know that males are at high risk of not having the coverage still, and those living in rural communities. And we don't have data that I can share other than what was already noted that has been broken out by gender and by age. But I do want to point out the tremendous state variation. And with Deborah's leadership in Massachusetts, only 2.3% of young people still don't have enough coverage, as compared to 18% in Texas. I want to highlight an article that recently was impressed by Josephine Lau, one of our young junior faculty members at UCSF, and she looked at the initial effects on young adults' receipt of preventive care, something that I've been sharing with you. And she was able to note that there is an increase for young adults ages 18 to 25, and so we, you know, the whole issue of ages is a challenge. So it's gone up to 50%. Where it used to be in 43%. She used MEPS data. The rates of lacking insurance decreased over time, both for partial year coverage as well as full year coverage. And at the same time, though, public insurance rate still remains stable. This is the slide that I want you to remember. Young adults had significantly higher rates of receiving a routine exam. It went from 44% to almost 48%. Again, very short, this is just sort of like early signs. More screening around blood pressure, cholesterol, dental visit, yet there was no change in influenza. So what she analyzed that insurance status really does account for a lot of this pre and post ACA differences in terms of implementation. Finally, I want to raise for you an important issue that has to do with explanation of benefits and the issue of confidentiality for young people. Now that we're getting more young people into systems, we need to recognize that there's a potential for tremendous conflict between explanation of benefits requirements and maintaining confidentiality. So I'll put in one more plug that we have done a brief where we have a variety of strategies of how to deal with EOB. And it's if you go to healthpolicy.ucsf.edu, you'll see this brief, or if you go EOB UCSF, it'll come up. And in January of 2015, California has implemented a new policy which will help the young person And also an older woman who may not want to have her EOB sent to her husband or the person who carries the policy, where that individual will have the right to designate where the EOB can be sent if they don't want that bill to be sent to their home. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.